Well, my name is Angus McRitchie. I was born in Winnipeg. My mother and father were born in Scotland and came to Canada about 1910. I was 18 when I joined the Army in September 1939. I was more or less out of school. I joined the Grenadiers not because of the unit, but because my friends were already in the military. I myself was in the Cameron Cadet Pipe Band and would have joined the Queen's Own Cameron Highlanders, except that the band was filled at the time. My friends encouraged me to join the Grenadiers, which I did. My first thought was to get into a band, which I also did.
What instrument did you play?
I played the drums. And they did have a brass band, and they wanted to start a bugle and drum band. Unfortunately, most of the people that had tried out for the band didn't have good enough training, so we were sadly lacking in drums. The bugles weren't bad. We were stationed in Fort Osmond Barracks, I think it was till May of 1940. And then we went to Jamaica. Some were dropped off in Bermuda on the way.
What type of training did you have here?
Training as far as military is concerned? Well, at first, they say I was wanted to be in the bugle band, but I first had to go into the company. Then it was the standard drill, rifle drill, the Vickers machine gun, which I liked, and of course the parade drill, I liked that too. From what I can remember, the other guns that they had were the Lewis guns. They seemed to be all stationed in the headquarters company. Anyway, as I said, we went to Jamaica. I was still in the company, and our duties down there were to look after an internment camp where they had German sailors, or POWs, or whatever you want to call them. And then, later on, a smattering of Italians. Well, it meant guard duty, 24 on, 24 off, which didn't appeal to me at that time. So I let the word out that I would like to get into the brass band. Well, it wasn't too long before I was approached, and I was very happy to get out of guard duties. In the band, I would say, were a privileged lot. We used to practice every day, and on Sundays, always the traditional parade to church and the concert right after under a big tree outside the church. While we were there in Jamaica, we were invited out to many places to play, which was it was fantastic, the treatment that they gave us. There was lots to eat and lots to drink.
People led a rather nice, relaxed life over there.
The civilians?
Yes.
The people that were living there, they looked upon us as not as professional soldiers, but as volunteers and civilians like themselves. And hence you were invited into their homes. And their home was just like your own home. You come and go as you pleased. and treated royally. We were there about 16 months, I believe. Then we had the orders that we were coming back to Canada, and from there somewhere else, but nobody knew where. The rumor had it that we were going to Hong Kong, but it was only a rumor. Now, there were the two best garrisons that the British had were supposedly Hong Kong and Jamaica. Jamaica we had already seen, and I sort of looked forward to going to Hong Kong, mainly to see what it was like. We were home in Winnipeg about 2 weeks, at least my draft was, and from there we boarded the train and off to Vancouver. In Vancouver we went aboard ship, and the first two or three meals, I think it was, we had mutton. It was an Australian ship, which had been used, it was originally for civilian passengers. Then it was 500 passengers. They brought over New Zealand airmen or Australians. The complement for them was 1,200. But for troops, it was 2,000. It was I forget the tonnage of the ship. It was called the Alatia. Unfortunately, it was a big ship, but a lot of it was off limits. It was the best places, I would say, were contained to the officers. Or the officers' quarters. On board ship.
Did you have an idea then you were going to Hong Kong?
It had been going around that we were going to Hong Kong. We were also, while we were on the boat, these news dispatches were coming out and telling you that the situation didn't look that good. It was a little cloudy. And we were also told that you might even have to fight your way off the boat. Two of our men that had been in the peacetime British Army had told me that if we ever went to Hong Kong, that you wouldn't stand a chance there. I always thought that, and had read that, Hong Kong was an impregnable fortress, the same as Singapore. However, it's just a little island, all unto its own. And what guns there were there, the big guns were facing out to sea. Unfortunately, the Japanese were already sitting on the mainland, and it didn't take them very long to come through. Our transport was diverted to the Philippines, from what I can remember, hence materials that we required badly never arrived, and even if they had, they wouldn't have done much good anyway. They would have only prolonged it a little bit longer.
When you arrived, were they already fighting or not yet?
No, we were there about 3 weeks. Well, I might say that in the 3 weeks, or just shortly after we arrived, we were paid. And I had talked to a British Army sergeant there who said that you fellas are lucky. You get a lot more money than we do. And with this Hong Kong money, we're never broke, so therefore you won't be. Which was very nice as far as I was concerned. Unfortunately, the first night out, I blew the works. So it really didn't go that far.
Go to bar?
No, that particular night we went to the British barracks and bought a bottle of Gordon's gin and drank that. And I can't really remember what else happened, but we were just left with a little bit of change as far as paper was concerned. We were there 3 weeks, I think it was, and only had one night out that I can remember in town. And from there we were told we had a parade on the Sunday after church, I believe it was, that we were moving to the island. We were stationed at this time in camp called Shamshapoona in Kowloon. Kowloon itself, or I should say the camp at Shamshapoona, was an old camp. I don't know when the heck the thing was built. But it was a typical British Army barracks, and not suited too well to the colonials, as they call us. However, we made the best we could with it. There were loads of bed bugs, but you could keep them under control, providing that all the conditions were ideal. As I say, we went to the, moved over to the island on the Sunday, and it was the next day, I think, when the first air raid came over, and that was the beginning of the end, as far as I'm concerned. I was stationed at Aberdeen Reservoir, I think. And where I was, there was no hostility. We could hear all the guns going. And our job, you say, I was in the band, we were attached as medical men. We were more or less just sitting around there waiting for orders. We did our guard duties on the bridge, etc. And finally, we were told we were moving.
Was there any evidence of guerrilla around there?
Not where I was stationed, no. So we went, we moved down to Aberdeen Village this night, and when we arrived there, they wondered what we were doing there. Nobody seemed to know what to do with us. So finally, the next day, we commandeered a truck. Sergeant Webster, who happened to be around at the time, and he drove us to the main city, Victoria. We went to the Hong Kong Hotel, I think was the name, but I'm not sure of the name. We went there looking for somebody that could tell us where we should be. And there were civilians in the hotel, in the lounge, cocktail lounge, and it was just as though it was another day. They were sitting and drinking and laughing.
How many were you at the reservoir? Do you remember? Were you a platoon or what?
No, there was a little bit more. Well, there'd be more than a platoon there. Well, no, maybe it might have been about a platoon, about 30, I guess, in there.
How were you feeling? Were you feeling uneasy by then?
Bewildered and also a little dumb, I think. When you're young, you don't quite realize the seriousness of the whole affair. And it was, in a way, an adventure, and this is about as far as it went. Anyway, it was basically that we were at this hotel, and they said, well, you'll have to leave here and go to some other place on the other side of the island. So we got in this truck, and away we went. When we got there, the British, they didn't know what to do with us, and they sent us up to the peak, to the hospital up there. And this is where we stayed, and that was about, only about a day or so, I guess, that we were there before word came through that a truce had been declared and that we were to all collect at Peak Mansions. Peak Mansions conditions with an apartment building, and the Japanese had taken this over to collect all the prisoners. We went there that evening, and we were billeted down, and we were also told to keep our noses clean, not knowing what the Japanese would be like. Well, it was a little scary in a way, being in there that night with the Japanese outside drinking and yelling and hollering, wondering whether or not they may just take off and come in and get rid of the works.
What were around them, guerrillas or regular Japanese army?
Well, they weren't. They were, I would say, their first-line troops. They were a fierce lot, really. I remember on our way down, I just have to keep moving a little bit faster in order to tell you what I thought of these people. We were there just for a little while, and then we were taken down to Victoria Barracks. But on the way to Victoria Barracks, we stopped at the university overnight. And we were outside on the lawn with these Japanese guards around us, sitting around a machine gun and leering at you, and thought they hadn't shaved for a while. One of them, as a matter of fact, was frothing a bit. He opened up a tin of bully beef or something with a bayonet, and then just started eating it with the bayonet. I wasn't sure how you take the Japanese at this point. Anyway, we went from Victoria Barracks, we were only there, I think, a night, then down to the docks and across to Shamshipo again. Shamshipo, the meals started off with, from what I can remember now, it was two meals of rice, one in the morning and one at night. And in the midday, there was a cup of tea. But it got that it was too much to make the effort to walk down the road to get the tea for what you got out of it. So you didn't bother, or I didn't anyway. Our cooks had never cooked rice before. Consequently, they didn't know how to prepare it like the Chinese. It was cooked in 45-gallon gasoline drums, which still had the smell of gasoline in it. And it was just cooked and boiled and stirred until it was one gooey mass. Not too appetizing at that point. As they say, we got two meals of that, and then the tea in the middle. And we were there, not too long, I think about a month, and then we were shipped back to the island, part of us, and over to North Point. North Point was a refugee camp right on the coast, or the shore. And these billets we were in at one point had been used for stabling horses. They were bug-ridden and not too comfortable. However, we were there from, I might say that our food got slightly better while we were over there. We had, on two occasions, I think it was, we had duck eggs, preserved duck eggs. Well, these eggs are, well, it was a sort of a coincidence. We had a book, an old Reader's Digest book, where they condense or take the best of the last 10 years' articles and stick them in a hardbound volume. And at the end of the articles, there's usually anecdotes. And one that I happened to read just at that time was one where the Chinese preserved the eggs, these duck eggs, in the ground for a number of years, and they're only used on special occasions, such as weddings. just had them a couple of times. We had a little bit of butter. They had flour, which they used to make buns. We'd get it at noon, I guess we'd call it. Two buns. And the unfortunate part about the bun was that the flour was full of weevils. And at first you started to pull out the weevils, and then you found that by pulling out the weevils you were losing most of your bun. So you sort of forgot about the weevils being in there. The rice that we got had worms in it. And that also went the same way. You just sort of blinded yourself to the rice with the worms, telling yourself, well, they're cooked, they can't hurt you. Now, we were there till, I can't remember exactly where it was, or what period of time, but we were shunted back again to Sham Shapo.
Did you work in any work detail?
At that point, there was no work for about 6 months or so before we even went anywhere, and then it was work parties over to Kai Tak Airport to build the runways there. I dare say they're probably one of the few airports that have had the runways built by hand.
You said you were attached to the medical corps. Were there ill men or wounded men with you or anything like that?
No, not at that point. Not where I was stationed when we went up to the hospital. Of course, it's where all the wounded were. But we seemed to be like outsiders. We were seemed to be in the way with everybody. However, we went back to Sham Shapo, and there were work parties going out of there, I believe, still to Kai Tak. But we weren't there too long, and they had a mass medical examination. They were sending the Hale and Hearty to Japan to work. The criteria for your medical fitness was they lined you up on one side of the road, and if you could walk to the other side, well, you were fit. Well, we didn't mind too much getting out of Sham Shapo. It was another adventure, maybe even a lease on life. We had heard lots of stories, you know, about Red Cross parcels and things like this. And incidentally, we did get one while we were in Sham Shapo, and it was one split between two people. But the parcel in itself was not the important thing. It was the trading that went on psychologically anyway with the people. One fellow might lose most of what he had got in bad trades, but at least it kept him occupied. Just before we left, if I remember right, we got one other parcel. Oh, did we now? Was that still in Sham Shapo? We got a fifth of a parcel anyway, split. And you just ate it on the spot. We got on to this. We left for Japan, and one group, I'm not sure where one of the groups were let off. We went on to a camp just outside of, or in, either in or just outside of Yokohama.
What was your boat trip like?
The boat trip was crowded. Where I was stationed on the boat was not in the hold, but in one of the hallways, and I slept with my feet up the wall. Mind you, also it wasn't that pleasant a trip. I dare say that it was much more pleasant than some of the other boat trips that the prisoners took. Our boat was a fast boat. We weren't on that boat too long. I'm just thinking dimly now that it maybe was 4 days or something like this, whereas the Americans would have been on 28 days on that boat, where a lot of people died from dysentery and just disease from filth. This camp that we went to in Yokohama, first of all, I should say, when we arrived in Nagasaki, there was a Japanese captain or something, an officer anyway, who was looking after us, and he was a real decent type. When we landed on the dock, he looked for something to eat for us, and somewhere he scrounged some buns. They were sort of a sweet, sugary top on them, if what I can remember. And we were each given five, and I thought, boy, this is the, you know, the living end, that we're really in clover now. Unfortunately, it didn't last too long, because he just took us as far as Yokohama, and then we were into somebody else's hands. Our first, as when we arrived in the camp, the first thing was to be lined up in the sort of the quadrangle of the camp, and the officer in charge giving us the big speech in Japanese with an interpreter giving us the stuff in English. And one of the things I can remember about him saying was that we were going to be in Japan and going to work hard in Japan until such time as our country was beaten. It wasn't too pleasant a thought at that time, but then, however, if you knew that it couldn't last that much longer.
How was your morale going each time, lower and lower? Did you?
No, my morale didn't go. It wasn't low at that point. It did get a little shaky later on. I developed beriberi. I must say that I went out to work in a shipyard, and one of the jobs that we were on, or that I had there, was working, putting up the the side plates on the boat, reaming them out so that the rivets could fit in there. And the reamer for me was pretty difficult to use. And I had a boss there who was just a little bit of a thing, but he was a mean bugger. And he had me drilling overhead into the bottom of the boat. And it was at that point, I guess I was getting pretty sick anyway. And that was the day, it was the living end for me. I just couldn't see myself going back to work. I went into the on sick bay that night and just told him I was too darn weak to go. I didn't feel good. And they took me off the work detail. And we had a job in the camp, what they called the pot inspector. And his job was when the pots came back after dishing out the meals, he supposedly would inspect them to see that they were clean before piling them in the kitchen. The real purpose behind the pot inspector's job was to get somebody who was in bad shape and on extra food, he would possibly build them up.
So they really wanted to keep you alive?
Well, this was not a job appointed by the Japanese. This was the doctor in the camp, Dr. Reed. And I got this job as pot inspector. And the unfortunate part about it was that I no sooner got this job than I got pneumonia. So that was the end of the pot inspector's detail. Well, in this particular camp, we also had an American doctor. And he had come from another camp up north, from what I can recollect. In this camp, they had had the roof had caved in from snow. And he had seen a lot of will die, or had experienced it. So when he came to our camp, he was a little hard-headed. And one of his sayings was when a person would come in on sick detail, you say, well, now you look the picture of health. Well, what are you going to tell your grandchildren when you live to the ripe old age of 190? What will you attribute your good health to? Well,
how did you take that?
How did I take it?
Yeah, is that an insult, sort of?
Well, to me, he didn't really say it to me. You see, I'm saying that he was hard-headed. But I was tied up with pneumonia at the time. Now, whether the good Lord was looking after me or what, I don't know. But I seemed to get pretty good attention from him. And when I came out of the hospital and I was going back to the lines, he said, well, what do you think about going back to work? I said, well, yes, I'll try it. So he said, well, we have this small work party working right in the camp itself, the nuts and bolts gang, they called it. And you sat there during the day putting nuts on the bolts and straightening welding rods. And then after a while, the Japanese decided that we should be going back to work. There's too many people off sick. And they started or developed a new work crew, and they called it Skoshi Shinyo, which meant light work. Well, the unfortunate part about the light work was that you worked a hell of a lot harder on the light work gang than you did if you had been on one of the regular jobs. They didn't take too kindly to anybody who was not well. They were a funny breed anyway. I remember one day one of the Japanese fellows fell off a scaffold and he was laying on the ground there, and I don't know whether he had broke his back or his leg or what, but the others just stood around him and laughed at him. It was a big joke.
They didn't have too much sympathy for their own men.
No, not really. I don't think they had any. The army in itself, or the people that looked after us, the worst person to be would be the third class private. The officer in charge was God, and right next to him was the sergeant, who had a great deal of authority. And if the corporal, for instance, had done anything wrong, he berated him, but he also slugged him. But it was the corporal's job then to go look for who else he can take it out on, and it would just go right down the line, till finally the only people left would be the prisoners ourselves. At the start, the guards were very bad. You couldn't turn right or left with them. You had to really watch yourself. But as the war progressed, I think they were getting a little more confident in themselves, and maybe they were getting a little bit more used to us also at the same time. Now, we were under the army for quite a while, and then we became under control of the company that we worked for. Now the army would take you out to work and transfer you to the 7-Up boys, as we called them, and they would be your immediate bosses out in the shipyards. Now it was all right for a Japanese to, or one of the army, to hit a prisoner. But it was no good if one of the civilian employees hit a prisoner. There was one occurrence that I can remember in this where the civilian was beaten up by the Japanese, not the army.
Was that because he hit a prisoner?
Right. because he overstepped his limits, I would say.
I mean, so they had a funny cold.
Oh, very, very funny. I had quite a bit of contact with the civilians themselves and kids that worked in the shipyards. You would talk to them. Now, one of the things that they would say was that they looked down upon us, we'll say, for being taken prisoner. And they would say that the Japanese, they would never be taken prisoner. They would rather commit harakiri. And one day I was talking to maybe about four or so of these Japanese people. And I said, well, yes, that is fine to a certain extent. I said, when the war is over, I said, the Japanese soldier who has committed harakiri, his mother and father are going to be sitting home crying when he's not coming back. Whereas with myself, when I go back, my mother and father are going to be very happy. And I also threw in another dig that when I get home, then I'm going to sit down and drink milk and eat lots of chocolate. This is one thing they never had. Milk was only for the infants, and it only came in a half-pint bottle.
How did you communicate? Could you talk Japanese?
Oh, yes. This was a matter of necessity. You had to learn how to speak to them, not grammatically perfect, but you got through to them with what you wanted to say. And you also had to understand what they were saying. Now, the food in this particular camp in Yokohama was good to start with. Well, when I say good, good in terms of the standard that we had had before. But as the war went along, it also got progressively worse, too. And it seemed that each time we made a move, the food was better and then would start to deteriorate. The main food that you got was barley. There was also another thing called kori, or a millet, that was used to for cattle feed, I believe. And it had a nice flavor in a way, at least for a hungry person. And to me, it was much better than the barley. Also, barley has got a lot of food value in it. It is no good for a person with chronic diarrhea. Now, they also brought in beans to eat. They'd be boiled up. Now, anything that you get in large lots, you immediately could be leery of, and beans was one that wasn't too good either as far as your stomachs were concerned. But we used to call them the bean splurges. We got very little white rice, almost nil, I would say. It would be thrown in with the barley, just a smattering of that. Now, at one point, when we were in this camp in Yokohama, they came in to do a lot of medical tests. And I don't know why, whether it was something political, something to do with the Red Cross or what, I have no idea. But they came in, did a bunch of tests, signs up, turn right here, lift your arm, bend over, and so forth. And out of these examinations, 96 of us, I think it was, were transferred to a hospital in Tokyo called Shinagawa Hospital. Shinagawa Hospital was a place where a person was sent just before he died so his death wouldn't be on the record in the camp. When we got there, the Japanese authorities, the doctors and whatnot, wondered why we were there. We weren't sick. Now, our idea, at least I would think it would be everybody in the Western world's theory anyway, that if a person is sick, what he really needs is more food to build him up so that he's ready and able to work. The Japanese theory is that if you don't work, then you don't get a working man's ration, you only get half. So there's just no way you're going to get any better that way. Well, we were in the Shinagawa hospital, as I say, half rations, and it was really half milked down soup. Now the base of the soup would either be a soy sauce or a meat sauce paste. It's a soybean derivative. And there would be daikon. It looks like a great big carrot, only or shaped like a carrot, long, but tastes like a parsnip, or worse. And this would be diced up in there, and there would have been a few pieces of meat diced. And I've seen them fight over dishing out this soup. The first thing they would ladle out was all the juice that would go into the various bowls. Oh, incidentally, there would be so many pots, we'll say, in one of these little bays in the hospital, there would be probably about a dozen in there. And so this pot was to do the dozen people. And they would ladle out the juice first, and then they would count out the pieces of meat, so that you got one, the other guy got one, etc., right around. Somebody got two, there was always somebody, another person would be yelling. I've seen a fight over a quarter of a spoon of rice. Not that it could have done anybody any good, but I guess this is the frame of mind a person is into. No, your own people did it. One person within the hut would be elected, at least in this one. And it didn't take very long before there'd be a fight, and then you'd have to have a new ladler. Well, we were there 3 weeks in this camp, and we were sent from there to another camp in a Tokyo area called Omori. Now, Omori camp, I didn't know anything about other than one person that was there. He was a sergeant, and his nickname was the Bird. He was known far and wide in Japan, this fella, for his tactics. And we were told before we left Shinagawa Hospital by other patients there that watch out for the Bird. Well, the first thing we did, we walked from the hospital to this camp, and then we were told to, we were paraded right into the parade square, and then told to take our blankets and open them up so that they could see what we had in there, which was nothing. And anyway, around the corner of the building come the Bird. Somebody yelled Kiyotsuki, attention, and we all come to attention. Well, this Bird, the Bird, he was quite a stocky individual, and also tall in Japanese standards. And he come through there, and he'd looked us over, just doing the same kind of an inspection that you'd find in on any dress parade. They go along and look at your uniform, etc. Well, he came along, and there was one chap there. He stopped in front of him, looked down at his feet. The fellow dropped his eyes to see what he was looking at, and the Bird immediately hauled off and let him have it. He knocked him back about 5 feet. The moral being, don't look down, just keep looking ahead. Anyhow, that set the tone for the camp there, as far as the Bird was concerned. Now we were put into...
Was he very cruel? Right?
Oh yes, he was a bad one. You had to really watch him carefully.
He took a delight, I
suppose. Oh, definitely. The camp was... it's pretty difficult to describe a camp. But there would be one main street with the huts on each side, with the doors facing towards the street. And right at the very end, there was the administration building. The rule in his camp was that as you walked out the door, you immediately turned towards the administration hut and saluted. He would be watching all the time for somebody who came out that door and didn't salute. My pastime was going out the back door so he couldn't see. I've seen him come in into a hut when everybody was out to work, or most people were out to work, and your clothes had to be stacked up on piles, and just so many inches going straight up. And there wouldn't be a damn thing wrong with the piles, but he'd just go along with his swagger stick or stick that he carried and knock every damn thing down on the floor, which you'd have to pick up when you come back from work. I also remember him coming in when they were ladling out the dinner. You're all set to eat. He walked in. Somebody yelled attention. Everybody comes to attention. The whole meal stops. And he'd just jump up on one of the tables in amongst all the food there, his boots, and just stand and look around, arrogant. And when he had finally, satisfied himself that he's inconvenienced us enough, then he would take off. This particular camp that we were in, each person had a number. I'm trying to remember what my number was. Maybe it might have been 1654. So therefore, my days off work was the 4th, 14th, and 24th of the month. Another person who was ended with an 8 will be off the 8th, 18th, 28th. The camp I had been in before in the shipyards, we got our holidays at the same time, or I should say our day off at the same time as the workmen in the shipyards. You may work 28 days and get a day off, and then work 3 and get another. There was no rhyme or reason to it. That was the only day that you got your bath.
Did you get any extra food, or did anybody, the people, slip you anything when you were working in the shipyards? Did you ever eat treats or anything?
No, I never ever got any treats there in the shipyard. The only thing that I can think of, as if you wanted to call it a treat, was something you had to work for, and it's coming up now. We were in this, as I say, we had been moved to this camp in Tokyo, and then because of the increased bombing in the Tokyo area, the interpreter in this camp told us they were moving us back to our old camp. And when we got back to our old camp, we were only there overnight, and then they split the camp and moved us north. Half of us went to a camp called Sundai, and I went to one called Ohasi. It's on the northeast coast. It was an iron mine, and the communication from Ohasi was right down to the coast to a place called Kamishi, I think it was. And this particular camp, you didn't go down into the mine, you walked up into it. We were at the 550 meter level, which is about 1500 feet, I would think somewhere in that area or thereabouts. And you started off walking. It would take you an hour and three quarters to get to work. You worked an 8-hour shift. It took you an hour and a half, an hour and 15 minutes, something like that, to get back. You weigh approximately 11 to 12 hours out of the day. in this mine, there was two sections. On one side, the work party was split into two. On the side I was on, one of the stopes that I was working in, a stope is a hollowed out place and you pull all this ore out and throw it into the cars and then push it down to the chute and then you come back for the next one. At that time we were doing about 3 cars a day. On the other side they were doing about 7. So they decided that what they would, they came to us and, you know, berated us for not working hard enough. And we said we were doing all we could. We couldn't do anymore. So when they switched sides, the gang that was doing the 7 before started putting in 5 and 6 cars a day or maybe even more. And we were expected to be doing 7 on the other side. Then they came out with an incentive bonus. It's called a rice ball, extra rice ball. Anybody who did 8 cars would get a rice ball. Well, some people would kill themselves working just to get this extra rice, and it wouldn't help you for the amount of energy you'd taken out of yourself. Well, when there was too many people getting rice balls, they upped the ante to 9, and then to 10. And when the last I remember in that mine was when we did 12, you could quit, and no rice ball.
Well, did you have equipment? What were you using?
Well, there was no shovels in the mine. It was like a glorified garden hole and a wooden dustpan that you pulled all this rock into and then lifted it, threw it into the car, and then came back again to refill it. Well, you couldn't put very much in it, especially if you were in a wet spot. The ideal place to get into was one where it was dry, it had been recently blasted, and you could get these great big rocks. So then with these great big rocks, you'd just, two of you would lift them into the car and honeycomb it so that you have a full car and no weight. But this didn't happen every day that you get the lucky one. On the line, there would be possibly, 5 or 6 cars. And going one way towards the chute. Now, if you were filled, if your car was filled, your Japanese boss would be yelling at the others to hurry up and get filled because he wants to take you down to get you emptied. And if you were on the end of the line, then he wanted you down also so that he could have the whole stream come back. You had to go right by the chute and then back through again. And I've seen it quite often there where we would run down with a half car. The other thing here was that the Japanese boss man, he was also getting a bonus on the number of cars that were dumped, full or otherwise. But there was one very disturbing incident in this camp, or in the mine itself, I should say. There was a young fellow, he was very tall, Japanese student he was a mining student, and he came into the mine there he was more or less just looking around. And he was, I would say about 5'11", somewhere in that area. And one day he came up to me and he said, you slow motion. I said, no, I'm not slow motion. I says, but I can't work any harder because I haven't got enough to eat. And he says, yes. He says, you slow motion. Well, I still insisted that I didn't say any more than that. And I forgot about it. The next day, I stopped. I'm working in this dope, and I stopped to blow my nose. He come right around the corner and he just come running up to me and then wham, knocked me back about 4 feet. There was absolutely nothing you could do. And he berated me again in Japanese and told me to get to work. And this happened about 3 times, I guess, that he came at me and hit me from one day to the next. And I got to the point that you just dreaded going up to that mine because of him. Not because of the work, but because of him. And finally one day when I was up there and he didn't come around, and I thought, geez, maybe the bugger's sick.
You're hoping.
So it was a few days after that, and I was talking to one of the Japanese bossmen there. Asked him where this fellow was, and he said, oh, he's gone into the army and he's down in some anti-aircraft unit. Well, a while later, this boss man happened to mention that this kid who used to be around the mine had been killed in an air raid. And at that point, my spirit soared. I don't know, if he had stayed there much longer, I think I would have gone, caved in.
Do any men get frustrated and try to attack, retaliate or anything like that?
Well, not in our camp that I can remember, but they did retaliate in one other camp. And it's funny, you're not sure. You're not sure what's going to happen. Oh, I'd like to go back a few years here in this one. That when we were in Champ Chapeau, I was on the medical staff, or orderlies, and there was an awful lot of dysentery. We also had diphtheria. We had an epidemic there and lost quite a few men. But in any event, I contracted dysentery. I went in the hospital. The day I came out was the day a Dr. Sato arrived in camp, equipped with his enema hose, and had all the medical orderlies paraded out in front of the medical hut, including Dr. Crawford, the medical officer. And Sato went into a great big tirade over why all our men were dying and whether or not we didn't want them to live. Also whether or not we were not doing our best. And through the interpreter, of course, he said, anybody who thinks they were doing their best, take one step forward. Which we all did. Well, he got quite put out at this point, and he went back to the front and he went through the same ordeal again and said, anybody who still thinks they were doing their best, take one step forward. Everybody took a step forward. So he started at one end of the line and started down with this enema hose and slapped the chaps right across the face. He went down the front line and came back partway up the second. He got tired, I guess, and went out to the front again, or I should say over to the side. And then he said to the interpreter again, anybody who still thinks that they were doing their best for their men, take one step forward and get killed. And at that point, Sato drew his sword. Well, I had just come out of the dysentery hospital, but at that point I could have almost gone back in again. But everybody was speechless. They didn't know what to do. And all of a sudden I heard click, click, somebody moved. And this fellow Varley, he was one of the Royal Rifles, he went around to the front. And up to Dr. Sato. Dr. Sato dismissed the whole works of us and motioned for Varley to go with him. Well, we figured, well, that's the end of Varley. That's just another bloodbath. They got over to the car, and as Varley told us after, Dr. Sato said to him, "Do you still think you were doing your best?" And Varley said, "Yes, sir." And he says, "That's good." He says, "You're the only good orderly." So you really don't know how to take these people.
Is that reason?
No. There was no way. He had a phobia at that time for anybody, but well, we had this diphtheria epidemic, but anybody coming outside from a hut had to wear a mask, a cloth mask. So he would get into a tirade on that one if he caught anybody out without a mask on. But yet another funny thing about him, I'm really rambling now because I've gone way back. We had set up part of the hospital in the old administration building. It was right on the seashore, a great big stone building, and there was, I don't know, 3-4 floors to it. And I was working over there with the diphtheria people, and hot water was your treatment, hot water and sympathy. And in order to get hot water, we had rigged up these water heaters, put two tin cans, one between, inside another, and then insulated by pieces of wood. Keep it away and then hooked up, and then we with a wire, and then we would bare the wires on the light switches, then hook it onto there and immerse it in the pail of water and start it up. Well, as Dr. Sato was making an inspection one day, and the first thing we had to do was dispose of everything we could, hide it. Sato came into our room, and right underneath the light switch we had built a little sort of stool so that the pail could sit on it, and also that there would be enough length of wire so it would immerse in the water. And Dr. Sato, he walked in, looked around, and then happened to look over, saw this thing and the bared wires, and he said, "You got water heater." I said, "No, sir, we have no water heater." He says, "You've got water heater." But he didn't do a damn thing. He just turned around and walked out. 10 minutes later, he could have cheerfully come back and probably shot you.
Did he minister? Did he use his medical knowledge?
No, not with any of us. No. The trouble was that he had got hell, I think, from Tokyo about the number of deaths that had occurred in our camp. But there was no way that you were going to stop the deaths if there weren't drugs available.
The diphtheria took an awful lot of men.
Yes, it took quite a few. Yeah, not just Canadians, but everybody. There was roughly 700 in that camp, I believe, at that time, British and Canadians, and Hong Kong volunteers.
And did you contact diphtheria?
No. No, but they were deathly scared all the time about this, and they were always taking swabs. And I was established as a carrier, positive or something, about the fourth or fifth, and you went into this little isolation place. Well, it was a rest. That's what all it was.
It's gruesome death.
Well, it probably is. I saw some tragedies too, but not with diphtheria. Dysentery and just plain run down. One in particular that wanted his Red Cross parcel. He had a phobia, I guess, for food at this point. And just kept telling him, "Well, shortly you'll be getting this parcel. Keep eating." But he wouldn't eat unless he had his Red Cross parcel. And that was an impossibility. We did get Red Cross parcels in Japan. We got, I remember one parcel that I got, or it was a half of one, and they were sort of graded as far as like a workman's parcel or an invalid food parcel or something. One would have sort of a cocoa in it, others had chocolate bars. This parcel I got, I could hardly wait to open it, and it didn't have the chocolate bar in it. I just about dropped dead. Very disappointed, because I didn't get my chocolates. But I never did have a phobia for food. Food didn't interest me. I guess I wasn't feeling well enough to really let it bother me.
How did you feel about... there was no medical supplies. What did you do for supplies? Just aspirin, was it?
For what?
Medical supplies.
Well, medical supplies, at the beginning, there were a few drugs around, I believe, like morphine, but it was only to be administered to the real ill. Somehow it disappeared. I never did find it. Somebody took it and used it.
Probably the Japanese.
No, not the Japanese, our own.
What did you do when a person... Did people have breakdowns, mental breakdowns?
Well, there was the odd one that went queer on various things. Food was the thing, I think, mainly that put the fellow over the deep end. I don't think it could be anything else. Confinement in itself couldn't be enough.
What type of punishment was meted out besides slapping the face? Were there any other... Were the prisoners given more severe forms of punishment?
Well, there were other forms of punishment, but in our... in the camps that I was in, we really didn't encounter anything like that. It was really severe, other than the beatings.
Mm-hmm. I think they needed you. By the workforce, is that the
Oh, yes. Well, this last camp I was in the iron mine, there was three shifts. And one of the shifts was the Canadians and the British. Another shift was the Koreans, and the third shift was Chinese prisoners. Well, the Chinese prisoners, I think, were the worst treated of all. The Koreans weren't prisoners, by the way. They were forced labor, I would call it, instead of prisoners. But the Chinese, they had no use for. But I don't think that they treated them any worse than they would their own prisoners, like convicts, for instance. They were pretty roughly treated.
So, did you get any mail?
Yes, I got a couple of letters, or three letters. I got one from my mother that was probably about 10 lines long. The regulations, I understand, were pretty strict on what you could say. Excuse me, or what you couldn't say. I got two from my brother. The second one came first, and there was quite a space apart there. The second one told me that in the letter my brother said that we're going to have a baby, so I felt that it was my mother that was having one. But it was really that my brother had got married a long time before, and it was he and his wife. But mail was almost non-existent. Rumors were rampant. I remember one time in Yokohama area, and there was a minister come in to give the church service, and he spoke English, and I don't know whether he was a United minister or Anglican or what, but in part of the service was the psalm, "Eye to the hills will lift mine eyes." And of course, all you had to do was just look up and you saw old Mount Fuji there. Well, since this fellow had come in and spoke English, I think everybody was listening to hear just what he was trying to tell you. In other words, secrets coming out, and he was just giving you hints. Well, there was more darn rumors went around over that than enough.
Wishful thinking.
Oh yes, just wishful thinking. But at least it was something that would occupy somebody's mind, eh? The same way as I was mentioning about the parcels. Now, in Yokohama, we had, whenever the Red Cross parcel would come in, immediately the market would start. And the doctor had even put up a blackboard on there with the current market rates. You know, this half pound of cheese was worth so many packs of cigarettes, or the chocolate bar was worth 10 packs, I think it was. A pack of cigarettes a square, this is how valuable this stuff was. But his idea was that the people were getting more out of the parcel in their trading than eating it. I got more out of eating the darn thing than trying to trade it, because there would be always something to try to do.
Did you get any pay in the camp in Japan? Any sort of money, any sort of stipend?
Yes, you got paid for each day you worked. You got 10 sen. 10 sen, if you worked 10 days, that would give you a yen. The current market at that time for a yen, I think, was 15 yen to the dollar. So that if you work 10 days, you get 1/15th of a dollar. However, with that little money, whenever it was possible, and this was just every so often, you would be able to buy cigarettes. And a package of cigarettes, they were tens, 10 in the package, was 45 sen. So that was 4.5 days' work to get 10 cigarettes. You didn't smoke very much in the camp, unless, now and again the Japanese worker would give you a cigarette if he really felt benevolent, and you'd probably work like hell for him that day.
How about your liberation?
Liberation? Well, it was a funny thing. The last day that we worked, on the way up, there was an Australian chap going up next to me, and he said, he says, I don't know if we'll work all day today, he says, but if we do, he says, this will be our last work day. And I said, and on the way we went. Well, sometime during the afternoon, or was it lunchtime, or somewhere in that area, anyway, they herded us. We were outside the mine around the machine shops, and they herded us into a tunnel. Now, we didn't know why we were being herded in, but apparently it was because Hirohito, the emperor, was giving a speech to the people. And the speech, I guess, was telling them that the war was at a close. Well, that evening, going back to camp, we were going through this little village, and you could just feel it in the air that there was something different. It wasn't another day, it was a different day entirely. We got to the camp, we had our dinner, nothing was different. In the morning we were up at 4 o'clock getting ready to go to work, and we drew our lunch, the same as your breakfast, and we weren't called out onto the parade ground. Well, then we figured, well, geez, something's got to be up. And the Japanese were still around, but they weren't saying anything. And that night, the lights were on all around the camp. Well, that could only mean one thing, that the war must be over. The Japanese had a hang-up about smoking inside huts. They're deadly afraid of fire. And you could only smoke in one spot, and that was in the center of the aisle over a big pail, so that they wouldn't burn up the building. And they tested them out by sitting on their bunk spaces and having a cigarette when the guard would come through, and he just looked and smiled and kept on going. Well, they disappeared. All the guards left the camp shortly after. The only ones that were left was the camp commandant and the interpreter. The senior officer in camp, who was an American, told us that the war was over, but nothing had been officially signed, so to keep our noses clean just in case something happened that it changed, that it wasn't over. We were in that camp roughly a month after, before we got out, and in that time they had dropped food to us, loads of it. We ate and ate and smoked just about 24 hours a day. You ate not because you were hungry, but because there was nothing else to do. Now, right after the war was over there, one of the first things that came into camp was butter in these 50-pound boxes. And you were dished out with a bowl of butter, which I sat down and ate the whole damn thing. I got violently ill on it, and I don't eat very much butter now. I never did, really, but at that point I wanted to try it. They brought in cigarettes. I don't know, 50,000 cigarettes came into the camp. They were of utterly no use anymore, so they were used for playing cards with, as poker chips. And as I say, we smoked until our tongues were raw. We were allowed out to walk up and down outside and go into this little town. And what the fellows used to do was go out and bargain off their blankets or whatever they had to the Japanese people for chickens. And you'd see a fellow just rushing in the thing, and before you knew it, the head was off and the thing was plucked and it was in the old pot. Pots were all in the parade square. Everybody had a fire. Well, there was a fire going all the time.
Did you feel your strength returning?
Oh, yes, to a certain extent. You felt much better, though. I guess it would be mentally. I think the first real feeling that you got that you were really free was the first plane that came over and sort of made contact with you. It was a cabin plane off one of the ships in the task force nearby, and he just threw out some cigarettes and whatnot, I believe, in a bag. And the message was that they didn't have very much on board, but because they had been at sea for quite a while, but there would be food on its way from, I don't know, Guam or someplace like this. Well, the first day that the planes came over, or the plane came over to drop food, it was a glorious sight too. But then you began to wonder whether it was really worth it. They would have two 45-gallon drums welded together, and it would be full of sugar and peaches and Lord knows what in it. There was everything imaginable anyway. And they would test for the wind first, and then they'd open up the bomb bay doors and out where this stuff would come. Unfortunately, the weight of the drums would snap the parachute ropes, and down they would come. And one particular day, there was five of them landed right in the damn camp. Peaches splattered all over the place, everything else. We put a sign on the, painted a sign, I should say, on one of the roofs. First of all, they had put on there so many POWs. I forget how many was in that camp, 300 or something like this. I couldn't really say for sure. And then when all this bombing bit started, we decided we didn't really need that food anymore. It wasn't healthy. And they painted on the roof, dangerous, no more. And the only thing I can figure out is that they misread it and it said it was dangerous no more. And they just come right through the valley and let her go. As soon as you heard aircraft, and it was usually when you were eating, you'd take off for the hills. It would just come right down when they broke. They lost a lot of food, but I think the idea was that if you only got 5% of everything they dropped, it was still something. So there was loss for the Japanese too in the area. It went, you know, we were in like a valley, so it would land on the other sides of the hills and whatnot. So then, this was liberation in itself. We were there for about a month, and then on from there to the down to the coast to Kanishi, and we went on board a hospital ship. The first process was to have a shower and go through a delousing process. Oh, incidentally, I should tell you about the delousing and the mental attitude, or I should say lice. I remember when we were still in Chamchapo, and this old gentleman from the First World War, a real nice man, and I was talking to him about this lice business, and he said, "Well, don't worry," he says, "it's starting now," he says, "and we'll all be lousy soon, no matter what you do." And I said, "No, sir, not me. I'm not going to get lousy." Well, lo and behold, I did get lousy, and the first thought, you know, that I just about died in the spot. You know, a louse on you. You know. Well, you contended with them after, but it was only in the wintertime that they really bothered you. Providing you kept yourself clean, you could keep it under control. But in the wintertime, there was no way you could get away from it, because there's always somebody else in the bed space there that didn't bother to wash and whatnot. Slept in his clothes all the time.
Did you have soap and water or anything?
There was soap. There was a type of soap they had there. There was water, outside wash stands, but no hot water. It was cold water that you would wash with. And as I mentioned, the only time that you really had a bath was on your day off, so it was a communal thing, and it would take about 50 minutes once. So in the one camp I was in Yokohama, there were, I think, 10 sections, and it would start off, today we'll say section 1 was first, section 2, 3, and down to 10. The next bath day, it starts with section 2 being first, and number 1 went to the last. So when you were the last section getting in, it wasn't that good. However, I don't think that now that the whole thing is over, I would want to trade the experience for anything else right now. If you can come out and have a healthy mind, I think you can look back and you can see a lot of things there, all lessons to be gained from just the experiences you've gone through.
Did you develop a great comrade amongst them?
Oh, there is, in a way. They may fight. Did fight amongst themselves. I mean, this is one thing, but never let anybody say anything about us, or else you're in for it. There is a lot of camaraderie in our group. We have the association, an annual reunion that we have, also a national annual reunion, and it's always good to get out to see these fellows once a year.
But I mean, did you feel a wrench, like when you left the camp and had to go on your own? When you got home, what adjustments? What was your hardest adjustment?
The hardest adjustment when I came home? Mm-hmm. was meeting people. When we arrived in Winnipeg, we were almost like a privileged race. Everybody was sort of going over backwards to you, so glad you're home, etc., etc. And you're wearing a uniform, and of course everybody that is in the army has his own distinctive patches, what group he belonged to and so forth. And whenever they would see your insignia, then they would come up and talk to you. And I always felt, for instance, if I was going into Eaton's, I'd be going in and I'd be rushing through the place because I couldn't stand for anybody to talk to me. But yet, we didn't have anything to do. We were still in the army, and you were going back once a month for a checkup. All which meant that if you didn't feel too bad, he said, "How are you? Not too bad. Okay, take another month." And with nothing to do, then, and being single, well, you had your own friends that you had built up through the years within the camp and without the camp. And you would meet downtown. We would sit there and talk, joke. But we were a group unto ourselves. There was people that would come along and sit with you and have a beer with you, and we would laugh about some of the experiences. Now, they were pretty grim, really, before, but when you're on the outside looking in, they became quite funny. And some of them didn't really feel that we were telling the truth in certain things that we would say. I guess because we were being funny about it, rather than looking at it from the dead side. But eventually all things have to quit, and these fellows, they would get married and so forth, and they have to get out on their own. They also have to find jobs. And they have gone their own way, but yet there is still the contact is there. If you see somebody, then you're pleased to talk with them, interested in, you know, how he's getting along, etc.
How about your physical health now? How are you?
Oh, physically I'm pretty good. I don't know, they've got me down for epidermolysis, which is a consequence of malnutrition. I have arthritis in my back and knees, but providing that I'm on medication, I'm fine, with just the odd time here and there that it really gives me a bad time. I'm still nervous. My nerves aren't that good, but it depends on where you are, how nervous you can get.
But you're actually better off than a great deal of them.
Oh yes, by far, by far.
And you've maintained a good position and job.
Well, the thing was that after the war, now what are you going to do? This just about floored me. You also, in addition to people wondering as to the state of your health. But when I was getting out of the army, now, what are you going to do? They're saying to you, what would you like to do? I says, I don't know, really. And they'd look down, these counselors would look down the list, and they'd say, well, there's a truck driver's job open at such and such a place, etc. And that wasn't for me. I didn't want to be a truck driver. So I said, well, how about a plumber? He says, an apprentice plumber, it looks like a pretty good deal. You're paying quite well. Well, he says, I'm sorry, you can't get you in there because it's a pretty closed shop. They only take on so many apprentices every year. He says, well, what else do you want to do? I says, well, I really don't know. So
how old were you then? About,
I was 25.
25?
When I'd come back, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very hesitant about the whole thing, so I thought the only thing to do is get away and start to think. So I went back to Jamaica. And I stayed there for 4 years. I came back to Winnipeg in 1950. And I came back on the urging of a friend of mine who had remembered that I had been quite good at figures in school. And he was just graduating as a lawyer and thought that he would like to take up chartered accountancy. And he wanted me to come back to do it with him. Now the thing was that you had to get through DVA on this. So I applied, and they told me I would have to apply to the Foreign Service branch in Ottawa since I was out of the jurisdiction here. Well, when I wrote to Ottawa, they sent me forms, and which I filled out and sent them back. And then they said that in view that the time had elapsed for taking training, and also that I was already employed and didn't need training in order to gain employment, they had to refuse it. So I wrote this friend of mine who, again, and told him what had happened. So he went stomping into DVA here in Winnipeg. And they said, well, you know, there wasn't anything we could do. Why don't you just write a letter on his behalf? So he did. And it was really a strong letter. Well, when that letter went to Ottawa, it didn't take very long before I got an answer from Ottawa telling me that in view of the fact that new light had been put on my application, they had decided to grant it, and I was to contact the Winnipeg office on my return, which I did. And then it was just the formality of getting into chartered accountancy, and they financed it up to a point that I was subsidized. And since then I've been successful in getting through and just carrying on. Yeah.
That's good. And what did you do in Jamaica?
Well, when I was in Jamaica, first of all, as I said, I went down there to get away and find out what I wanted to do. Now, people came to me and said, well, if you're going to stay, how about a job? I don't know what to do. So they were all rounding up jobs for me. I could have been an insurance salesman. I had that one cinched. But I couldn't see myself selling insurance to a bunch of strangers and not having sold. So I went with the commission agency manufacturers representatives. And in this one, they were grooming me as a salesman in the textile end of it. But I really wasn't a salesman. I was more for figures. So there was a rich man in Cuba owned two textile mills and had decided he was going to build one in Jamaica. And our managing director knew him quite well, and he also became the managing director of this textile mill. So he transferred me over to there, and I started off in all accounting. The first thing, of course, was they had to build the building, and I was keeping track of all the building costs. How much it cost to, we manufactured our own bricks, etc. So I was there until such time as this friend of mine wrote me to come back home.
Did you like Jamaica?
Oh yes, I liked it down there. I don't know whether I'd like it now, but times have changed an awful lot. There's an awful lot of tourism has gone on the North Coast.
Yeah.